ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm speaking with Warad Seeger, the co-founder and CEO of Powered Analytics, a data science company that empowers media companies, brands, and agencies to understand global audience demand for television content via its cutting-edge artificial intelligence platform. A technology entrepreneur and leader at heart, Warad has led Powered Analytics' vision and strategy since founding. He's responsible for all strategic facets of the company and has led its impressive growth from inception to global expansion. With an academic background in neuroscience, he believes society's greatest advancements emerge from the intersection of science, technology, and entrepreneurship. He also published the world's first quantitative master's thesis on founder succession in technology companies. Warad Seeger, thank you so much for joining us today. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about is, you know, we've had this increase over the past few years in proliferation in content, and then this unprecedented fragmentation of audiences, which obviously leads to less ability to measure audiences across platforms. And so this led you to develop this global TV measurement system. And for listeners who aren't familiar with your product, could you describe what it is and what makes it unique?
Sure, yeah, and thanks for having me here as well. Yeah, look, I mean, you described the three trends that the media industry, and in particular, the TV industry is facing now in terms of platforms proliferating, audiences fragmenting, and the industry as a whole struggling to measure these audiences across those platforms. So what we've developed is a global measurement system that, in short, can tell you how popular any TV program is anywhere in the world. So that's a 10-second overview of that. obviously, it's much deeper. Yes. I can pause there and sort of hand it back to you. Yeah.
So that is quite a sweeping statement. So I'm going to jump in and say, how do we measure how popular a TV show is? And you do this globally, and you also do this in real time, cross-platform, really. Every platform, and also by country, so that we can drill down and get relevant cultural nuances. How do you do that?
Well, yes. I mean, those characteristics of the measurement system that you just described, I mean, they're critical because of the earlier trends that we talked about. So, for example, if we want to say, you know, how popular is a TV show like Stranger Things is in Japan, right? Now, that particular program could air on a number of platforms. It could air on Netflix. It may not even air in Japan, right? So, but that's just an illustration. And now you have these thousands, tens of thousands of TV shows in all sorts of different languages that all, by the way, because of the windowing rights and stacking rights, you know, air on a specific platform in a certain market. They air on another platform, another channel in another market. They come off window and then they change and then another platform picks it up and so on and so forth. So this incredible amount of fragmentation and confusion really in the industry is happening, that you really need those characteristics they talked about, a measurement system being real time across platform and country specific. All that says basically is that the measurement system should be able to tell us how popular a TV show is in a given country, regardless of what channel or what platform it airs on. How we do it is really, it started by us saying, how do people express their demand for TV content? So the system is called a demand measurement system. So, you know, the goal is to measure how much audience demand there is for any given program in any given country at any given point of time. And so we went out and said, how do people express their demand for content? And in this day and age, you know, with what, 3.7, you know, probably by the time of recording this conversation, 3.7 billion people are connected to the internet. Very soon, the entire planet is going to be, or most of it. And so one of the primary ways that people express their demand for TV content is online. So we said, okay, how do people do that online? And, you know, it turns out there's a number of platforms or avenues where people express their demand for content. So if I'm a fan of a TV show and I'm staying in Hollywood, LA, then I can express my demand for it in multiple ways. I might watch a trailer for my favorite TV show or an even new TV show that I'm finding out about on a video streaming platform. I might then go and do some more digging and research about it. So I might check out some wikis or some fan and critic rating sites and see how it's being critiqued or received by fans around the world. I might go on social media to talk about it with my family and friends, see what the conversations there are about it. I might check out some blogging sites about it. I might even go and, if it's not available in my local market, I might go and pirate it off a peer-to-peer network or a file-sharing network, and so on and so forth. So there's all these different avenues online where people are expressing their demand for TV content in different ways. So coming back to the question of how, well, one, we went out and said, okay, let's capture all the data streams from all of those different avenues where people are expressing their demand for content. And there's a lot of them. And two, perhaps more, importantly, is once we capture all those data streams, then the question becomes, how do you combine that? So, well, you know, if someone writes a comment on a social media platform, what does that actually mean if someone writing a comment on, you know, the Facebook wall or something for a TV show? What does that actually mean in terms of them expressing their demands for that TV show, as opposed to them, you know, going on some browser-based video streaming site and streaming an entire episode? So how do the two different actions relate to each other? How do you combine them? What do they each mean? So what we've had to come up with is a weighting system that we call demand rank. And demand rank is sort of a play on Google's page rank and Facebook's edge rank. Essentially, it's a system that allows us to combine all the different signals together so that we can measure the popularity of content on a single scale.
I have a question.
So basically, the system. Yeah. Go.
So one of the things I'm curious about in this weighting, or actually a number of things, are there differences between cultures or genders in terms of the relevance of any of these things? Like searching may be more relevant, searching out content proactively may be more relevant to twig of engagement for young men versus commenting socially may indicate more engagement or demand in women. Is there a difference between gender? Is there a difference culturally in terms of how these things are expressed? And then how do you constantly, I mean, because these avenues of expression are always changing, do you have a team that's constantly scouring and saying, okay, you know, here's this new site or this new thread, this new thing, and we're going to feed it in? And how do you beta test, like what's the lag or testing that goes into making sure that your demand rank is both constant and robust, but up to date as the technology is in flux while it's being measured? Lots of questions baked in there. Sorry.
That's all right. I think there's kind of two umbrellas. The first is, are there any country-specific differences or cultural nuances or demographic-specific trends on how people express their demand for content? And the answer is absolutely. You know, we see that all the time. And the answer to that, the solution is, you know, you need to capture all of it. And so it's not enough to just look at what's happening on social media. Right. And there's a lot of people who do that, listen, you know, social media listening tools and so on. And that, because that, while that's valuable, it only gives you one side of the story because it's limited to that universe. And it's not just enough to look at fan and critic rating sites because, again, that only gives you that limited view of that universe. And it's not enough to just look at like photo sharing sites, like, because that only gives you that side of the story. And it's not enough to look at peer-to-peer or piracy sites and so on and so forth. So the answer is, you need to capture all of these different avenues. We call it the entire ocean of where people are expressing their demand for content. And within that, we actually then segment and break down and provide profiles of, look, this particular TV show has this much demand in that given country. And by the way, those are the particular demographics that are really expressing that demand for that show. Yeah, absolutely. So we provide that breakdown as well, which is incredibly valuable when it comes to programming and marketing, of course. The second umbrella of questions relate around, you know, do you have a team of people that looks at this and adjusts this? Then the answer is yes. And it's always an ever iterative process. So, you know, the system relies on the core of the system relies on a logical weighting system. So the logic behind it, that doesn't change. However, it's always being fine-tuned because, as you say, there's always a new platform that comes up. You know, a social media platform could be popular today and it could die tomorrow. And there could be a local platform that's popular in a local market. So a lot of what we have to do is actually, you know, stay in touch and plug into as many of these avenues and streams as possible.
One of the, I have two other questions. One is, so we're saying demand as an expression is sort of equal to popularity. Would you say that buzz is different and distinct from popularity? Like, for instance, if I'm looking at Man in the High Castle or House of Cards, they may have a lot of buzz. Does that translate into demand, and is demand the same thing as popularity?
Yeah, so good question. What does popularity mean? Right.
Yes.
I mean, the industry
yes,
is so
exactly.
fragmented. And industry, and then look, depending on who you are and what industry you're in, the very definition of something being popular as it relates to your applications could be different. So, you know, we can all look up a dictionary definition of it. But for the TV industry, what does popularity mean? And even now, you know, early 2017, depending on who you ask in the TV industry, you'll get different answers. So if you ask a linear TV network in the United States, they'll say popularity is ratings, mm-hmm. right? So because that's their bread and butter. A show that has higher ratings provides higher ad revenues, so it's rating. If you ask an SVOD platform, what does popularity mean for you? They will say it's customer acquisition, it's engagement on our platform, and it's churn reduction. We don't care about linear ratings. So depending on who you ask, you get different answers in terms of what does unpopular actually mean. So this is actually one of the reasons why we had to come up with this new system. And we called it a demand measurement system. So yes, for us, the very definition of popularity is changing. And by the way, it will continue to change. But demand for content doesn't change. And so for us, the key driver that drives customer acquisition, engagement, viewership is demand for content. So that's kind of the terms of the definitions, if you like. What the other side of it, does buzz equate demand? Does that equate popularity? And not necessarily. And that's why we had to come up with this weighting scale, because as you rightly point out, there are some shows that have really high buzz, but that does not actually mean that they have really high demand, because it could be that a small group of avid, passionate fans are really loud about it. And so you see a lot of noise about it, and there could be a lot of marketing behind it that sometimes that does translate to demand, and that lifts the demand for it in the general public. Other times it doesn't. And so that's why the weighting scale allows us to filter out the noise, because generally speaking, watching an episode is a stronger indication of demand than pressing like on a post, right? Because one of them takes an hour of your time, and the other action takes a millisecond. Well, so that's why the weighting scale does, yeah.
Well, and this leads actually to another one of my questions, is that if we have proliferation of content and platforms, it may mean that a consumer never finds the content that's aimed at them. So if I'm a network, how do I define if my problem is a content problem or a discovery of content messaging problem? You know, like, is the reason the demand is low because my marketing push is bad, people don't know where to find it, they're unaware of it, or is it because my content is bad? And I'm sure at the ends of the bell curve, you know, if I have a super fantastic show, it's not an issue. Or if my show really reeks, it's not an issue. But if I'm in that middle ground where, you know, how do I know? How does knowing the existing current demand tell me what it is about the program? I mean, is there more nuanced aspects of this material?
Sure. And look, that's a question that a lot of the networks and even OTT platforms around the world really struggle with. The simple answer is, you know, you don't know. If you're just sitting behind your own network and you're just saying, well, this show is not performing well, is that because no one likes it, or is it because no one knows that I have it? I mean, you can come talk to us and we can help you out. The way we would do it is that, look, sometimes we would work, let's just hypothetically say we're working with an OTT platform in Germany, right? And they might have a program that is not really doing well for them on their platform. And let's just say they have a couple hundred thousand subscribers or half a million subscribers. We are seeing, however, for that same title, really high demand for it in the German market. But when they look at their consumption numbers on that platform, it's not doing well within their universe, which is a few hundred thousand subscribers. So this is one of those cases when we would tell them, look, this program actually has higher demand in the market. People just don't know that you it's on your platform. So the question is actually more nuanced. The question actually has multiple layers. Yeah, because in that particular case, there is demand for that title in that market. People just don't know that it's on your platform, which is one of many platforms in the market. So you need to go out and actually tell them and advertise that the show is on your platform, and that way you can acquire some of its fans on your platform.
Well,
so,
that's interesting.
I mean, coming back to your question, yeah, because if they just see their own consumption numbers, they will judge the program to be not popular and might, you know, not continue licensing the second window or the second season or whatever.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. We've been surveying young millennials and their ability to recognize the parent brand from the program, and it's the numbers are really awful, you know.
And
we're trying to get back at, you know, is it discovery is becoming more and more an issue. And when people have such, you know, if we're talking about an attention economy, really, right, you've got to grab that attention and get it. If people aren't able to find it, or if the user experience is so bad. I mean, that's the other thing I'm curious about, is the why, you know, why isn't it working? You know, in terms of anecdotal stories from folks, what we've heard about, let's say, Amazon and the user interface, just some people really like the content, but they say, oh, I pirate it just because I can't bear the interface. I mean, that's just appalling.
Yeah, that's right. And I think you touched on really important points. So from our perspective, and certainly from at least personally my perspective, I think there are two big problems facing the TV industry. One is measurement, just understanding what is popular, where in itself, you know, we've laid out that's becoming difficult. And two is discovery and recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is so much content, and the barrier to entry, by the way, for content production is coming down, quality of production is coming up, so competition is increasing. You're getting this really unprecedented fragmentation of content production platforms. You know, as previously was, you know, you can count them on two hands who was producing quality content. And combined with the other trend, the other consumer and technological trend of really increased broadband penetration, faster internet speeds, more devices, easier access to content, and more people ultimately watching content, then you get this mix, this chaotic mix of how do you find the right content at the right point of time? And as a network, as a content provider, as an OTT platform, how do you serve the right content to the right consumer, to the right device at the right point in time? So the discovery and recommendation problem becomes a really big issue for the industry, and it will only get worse.
Yeah.
But and I think the UX side of it is a subset of that problem, because the UX also drives that. But underneath it, it's actually the artificial intelligence of recommending and helping a consumer discover a new title. I think that's the second biggest problem. So what we've actually also been working on is a solution to that, is a discovery and recommendation engine that we're now rolling out with our OTT clients, but one that is context aware. So if you look at like existing discovery and recommendation engines, they're all semantic based. So on doesn't matter what OTT platform you're subscribing to, it will generally say, you know, you watched TV show A and TV show B is similar to that. Hey, so do you want to watch that? But it lacks context around who's with you, who's sitting next to you, what time of day it is, what day of the week is it, because you may watch different content different days of the week, and so on. So these are all problems that I think the industry will grapple with, but it is solved technologically. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. Another aspect of what we were looking at with these young millennials is how do you find the content that you find? And so much of it actually comes from the personal network, sort of this, and not your most intimate friends, but the strength of the weak ties across your social network. And so as opposed to recommendations provided by the service itself, that was sort of farther down the line. And last was the advertisement. One of the things I'm also curious is as people are moving more and more, as the younger digital natives are moving off platforms into messaging, do you have a window into messaging that where it isn't necessarily out and out loud, but their engagement may be somewhat hidden? Is that something you have access into? Are you able to get that?
It really depends on what platform they're using. A lot of the platforms are private and encrypted, and they should be.
They should be using messaging platforms. Right.
Yeah.
But I wonder, I think, yes, they should be. And yet if I'm having a conversation over, let's say, Facebook Messenger, and I say something about a flower store and up pops the advertisement for the flower store, I'm like, that's not very private. I did not mean to send an ad that way. Or some of the, I mean, there's definitely the creepy big data sensation is floating around in the background. One of the things also that I'm curious about is we look at these algorithms to tell us the history of what happened or predict what you might like, but can we use it to predict what programs should be created? You know, so not only a program exists and I'm going to serve it up to you, but here's what you should be developing content-wise, because it turns out that there's a secret demand for, you know, Viking kickboxers in, I don't know, steampunk or something, you know, that some weird niche is actually strangely popular. Is there also not only a recommendation to consumers, but do you produce recommendations to networks in terms of content demand that seems to be really hot?
Absolutely. Yeah. So that was always a goal of ours, you know, when we first started even 4 years ago, was to eventually, because we knew we had access to so much of what people around the world demanded in terms of content and what they were saying about us, what they were consuming, what we were seeing, what they were actively watching. Mm. We knew that we could pick up trends and we can understand that, you know, certain genres are increasing in a certain market. You know, vampires could be really dying out in the US, but they could be peaking in China. And so you can understand also not at a global level only, but at a regional basis, you know, what content trends are and to drive your production decisions. But it can actually go even more granular than that. And this is work is now starting to come to life where, you know, we start to understand at a very, very micro genre level that this particular type of program with that particular actor and, you know, this particular setting, you know, will have a high demand. So in the data science terms, we call that the negative spaces. And I think that's kind of the difference. People ask, what's the difference between statistics and data science? Is that, you know, statistics tells you what has happened and you can keep doing more of the same. Data science can point out the negative spaces. It's probably the easiest way to explain it to the industry, and that we can point out negative spaces, which meaning that there is a certain type of content that is in high demand, but isn't being addressed right now with existing content in the market. So that's one of the things that you can also do as well.
I would think that's sort of your golden or brass ring. I guess that's the illusion I'm trying to find. Definitely. Mm. One of the things, it's interesting. There is an article I just read today in The Economist that was suggesting that the long tail wasn't really going to work in an attention economy. And I wasn't sure I agreed, because I almost thought it's, you know, it's the Netflix model of it's a big house with many niches so that I can like something very different from somebody else, but we both go to Netflix and it's the long tail works fine. It's a collection of long tails. But you would know far better than I. What do you think of the long tail of the niche? Is it going to go away or is it going to be fed? I mean, how do you see the balance here?
Yeah, look, I think it's probably, on the balance of things, relatively myopic to think that the long tail is, you know, it's going to be irrelevant, or that it's only going to be the tent poles that really drive. I mean, you're always going to have the tent poles, right? And the at least on the theatrical side, that are going to drive the highest revenues. But on the TV world, and certainly, you know, even the definition of TV is, as we know, is starting to collapse. But certainly with a lot of short-form content as well, and the barrier to production for that content coming down, I certainly do think there is a need for a lot of niche content. And in fact, the future may not just be just, you know, a big house where, as you called it, where everyone goes to and selects their type of content. There is also what we're seeing is the start of a new model where you can have an app or an OTT platform or both, really, that is very localized and very niche in its content selection and content offering. So that, you know, make it up. If you like Japanese anime, you know, there's one place to go to. right? And it serves, and they compete on price, they compete on content selection. It's cheaper than getting a, you know, a mainstream OTT platform, but there will always be those fans. Or and you can imagine the future, you know, fast forward 3-4 years from now, you're going to have 5G and 6G and 7G, and, you know, streaming is not going to be a problem, and you're going to have multiple apps on your devices that each provide you with different types of content that you're interested in.
Well, I think there, I still, you know, I have lots of apps, but I use about 4 of them. I mean, so there's that sure. sort of Pareto principle, you know, 80-20. One of the things mm-hmm. that I've been learning more about, and I think I'd be curious on your take, is blockchain and what that will do for disrupting certainly the YouTube style, you know, those types of entertainments, you know, where you have direct distributed, direct to consumer. Mm. You know, do you think that that will upset things? Do you think it will change things? Will it affect how you measure things?
Yeah, I mean, so far we haven't seen, you know, the blockchain technology or even concepts applied too much, at least to the mainstream media industry. I think probably if, you know, this is me personally talking, I think if it manages to cross the barrier from the early adopters and, you know, sort of cross the chasm, so to speak, and have more of the wider population use it, at least on the financial side, that's when I really think it could have an avenue to materially disrupt the media industry, because you start to have people can essentially vote their attention span, right, over their time. Well, because of the micropayment transaction that can give the contents, yeah.
Right. I mean, there's a music site which is going live this quarter, and in the fall, there's a media blockchain company that will launch their content. So that's sort of on the horizon. And I think initially they're going to have curated content, but then it will be totally democratized. But I think initially, because they, for precisely that reason, is to sort of have a solid start. But I that's going to launch in the fall.
I think it'll be fantastic.
It's really exciting.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the things I'm also
because, you know, that's, I mean, it'll take out a lot of problems from the existing business model of the industry, which is kind of archaic, so to speak.
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that it was kind of a dawning for me was understanding one of the things we struggle with is the lack of payment for any valuable content. That the entire universe, the ethos, that's the word I'm looking for. The ethos is free. One of, you know, I'm not going to pay. It's access, but no payment. And of course, that's because the technology when it launched was you couldn't pay. So you didn't pay. So mm-hmm. people are used to not paying. But if there is a new system where it's decentralized and you can pay, and it can be micro payments, so it doesn't really hurt too much. I think it's really going to revolutionize. And also what you have is each new generation of people, it just is, you know, the digital natives, it's just a different, their experience is entirely different than many of the executives who grew up with television.
And I think we'll have a big impact in terms of the content production side, which, you know, we also know from being inside the industry, is still relatively archaic in terms of the green lighting process. And
yes.
So I think that, you know, but that's a different topic for another day.
Absolutely. I am curious about piracy, because piracy is something that we've also looked at, and it's really interesting. A lot of young millennials are pirating. I think 69% are pirating. 67% mm-hmm. don't think there's anything wrong with pirating. And it's not so mm-hmm. much, I mean, they'll pirate the debates. I mean, these are things that are free. Then they pirate mm-hmm. them, and it has to do, there's where your user experience and familiarity and your habits die hard. So how does piracy and pirate data, how does that feed into what you're looking at? I presume you must be looking at piracy data as well, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really important signal of consumer demand for content. And so we'd actually developed, when we first started, technology that allowed us to see traffic streaming across file sharing sites, peer-to-peer protocols, so all decentralized traffic on the internet. And it's a really important signal, because people are telling you what they're interested in. And I think, you know, there's probably multiple layers to that as well. One, there are a portion, or there is a portion of those users that have grown up with it, and it's second nature, and it's what they do even for content that's freely available. There's another side where people can't access right. the content as well. And certainly that side, you know, I can personally empathize with. You know, I grew up in New Zealand, and you know, let me tell you, getting content like day and date from the US and New Zealand, at least a few years ago, was a dream for New Zealanders. And so I've been on record telling the industry, actually, and maybe even at the same Variety Summit that you mentioned earlier, saying that I have pirated content before because, you know, let's just say your favorite TV show is Game of Thrones and you're in New Zealand and you don't want to watch the first season and you get told that, oh, you know, that's coming out in 6 months or 5 months, but it's already aired, it's season finale in the US, you know, someone take my money and give me that season for me to watch, right? I mean, just let me buy it somehow.
Right.
But it's not possible. And so they, as a consumer, you have two options. One, never watch the TV show because as soon as you go into your Facebook feed, all your American friends are going to
ruin
for
it for you.
Because you're going to show you all the red wedding and whatever else, you know,
exactly.
and pictures from that. And you haven't even like started watching the season. So, you know, you're like, might as well not bother. Or you can keep up with it by pirating. And most fans, at least avid fans of the content, will take the latter approach.
Right. Of course. Well, you know, I realize I've already used up my half hour of your time. It's gone really, really quickly. Thank you so much. We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have helped bring the program to life. First, the incomparable voice artist, my friend, Rob Naughton. Thank you. Our production team over at Microfame Media, a big thank you. And thank you to our guest and new friend, Ward Seeger. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.